Hi, Jim.
Hi, Christian. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'll turn my video on since you've got yours on. Okay. I'm not in the light there. Doesn't matter. So thanks for doing this.
Sure.
It must have tickled your fancy.
It did. So you're doing the audio recording of this, and you're going to sort of process it later somehow?
Yeah. Yes, I'm recording audio, which is definitely happening. Yep, check that. And I thought we would talk about some maths, and then I will try and edit it into something a bit more polished. So I'll add a bit of intro, and then whenever there's anything I need to go and look up or add in a reference, I'll cut in something like that. But the main aim is, I just thought, since maths is so enormous, when I start talking about a topic, I can go, oh, it's something to do with this, or this guy does something incomprehensible to do with whatever object. I thought I'd talk to some people who are doing maths and find out what excites them about the thing that they're doing that I don't understand.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure you're not going to put any of this video on the web, because I did not shave and you're on the deep inside pillow dead. I'm not ready for video exposure. Yeah.
It might help to turn the video off, because sometimes if bandwidth gets restricted, then the quality can suffer.
What about the sound quality? It just occurs to me that I'm just using the standard input of my Mac. Would you like me to see if I can find a headset to put on?
No, that'll be fine. I think as long as one of us does, that's okay. It should cut out feedback.
I wasn't thinking about feedback only. I was just thinking about sound quality of a recording of a voice.
No, it should be okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So you said you wanted to talk about something to do with, well, you work in combinatorics and probability. Okay, so what I think I'll do is I'll ask you to introduce yourself, and then have you got something in mind that you want to talk about?
I do, yeah.
Okay,
I'm working on this week.
Lovely. Wait, I'll get started then. So who are you and what do you do?
My name is Jim Kropp. I'm a mathematician at UMass Lowell. I also run a blog called Mathematical Enchantments. My research is mostly focused on probability and combinatorics.
Okay, lovely. What are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on a really bad way to sort things, which is a lot of fun to study because it sort of hugs the line between doing the job slowly and utterly failing to do it at all. In a quite intriguing way. What I like about it is it doesn't remind me much of anything else. You know, a lot of the time in mathematics you encounter a problem, you say it's kind of like things you've seen before, you can solve it because it's there to be solved, but no one would really miss it if you didn't. And every now and then you hit something, you think, well, that's strange and different. And so for me, that's a part of the attraction of it. So it's a method of sorting n tokens, numbered 1 through n, that works whenever n is even, and fails whenever n is odd. So right away, I've never heard of anything with that feature, an algorithm that does this. It's a random algorithm in some ways, because the idea is that you can sort of make choices any old way you want, and regardless of how myopic you are along the way, if n is even, all the things end up being perfectly sorted into order. So when we were talking by text before, I thought you might want to get some bowls and some Scrabble tiles.
Right.
I don't know if you had a chance to do anything like that.
I can go and do that if I need to do it. Will Bananagrams tiles work?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Or slips of paper numbered 1 through 6 would work.
Right. Give me a moment. Right, okay, I'm back with Bananagrams tiles.
Okay. So if you've got A, B, C, D, E, and F, that would work fine.
Okay. Surprisingly hard to find.
Well, any tiles that are distinct you could use, because you just want to sort them as water.
Yeah. At some point I'm going to confuse myself there. So... What am I missing? I have A, B, C, E, and I'm doing some bad sorting here. The ones I'm rejecting, I'm throwing back in the bag.
I'll have to pull out.
Right, I have A to E, and I'll pick an R in the end. Right, okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So to do this, we're going to need 7 containers, 7 bowls,
okay.
7 cups, something like that. You can do it with 7 heaps. The problem with heaps is if the border of one heap gets too close to the border of another heap, it can be unclear which heap a given tile belongs to. Okay. So that's why I recommend using cups or bowls or containers of some type.
What I'm going to do is draw 7 circles on a bit of paper.
Sure, that sounds fine.
Okay.
So put all 7 of the tiles in the middle circle.
There is a middle because there are 7 of them. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, is that done?
Yep.
Okay, now there's one and only one kind of move you're going to be allowed to do in this game. And that is to find a circle that has 2 or more tiles in it, pick 2 tiles from that circle, and move them to the 2 adjacent circles that border the circle you just removed them from. The smaller numbered one, I guess I should say the one that's closer to the front of the alphabet, goes to the left, and the tile whose letter is closer to the end of the alphabet goes to the right. So those 2 you're sorted. You're putting them in sorted order.
Okay.
And don't try and be clever about it. Just choose 2 at random. And one of them will be before the other. That one goes left. And the other comes after in the alphabet. And that tile will go 1 heap to the right.
Okay.
So now you have a heap of 5 in the middle.
Yep.
And then you have a heap of 1 and a heap of 1 on each side. So there's really no choice about which heap you're going to do this move on for your second move. It has to be the one in the middle. But again, you can pick randomly which 2 of these tiles you're going to use.
Okay, I've done that.
So now you've got 3 tiles in the middle, and now you've got some genuine choices to make. If there are 3 different piles that have 2 or more tiles in them, so do whatever you feel like doing. You might want to narrate what you're doing, just so I can follow it.
Okay, I'm going to move the 2 tiles that are in the 5th pile back. So I have 4 in the middle one and 1 in the 6th pile now.
Okay.
And should I keep going?
Yeah.
So now I've moved 2 from the 4th pile. I've got 3 in the 3rd pile, 2 in the 4th, and 1 each in the 5th and the 6th. So I think I will move some stuff out of the 3rd pile. I now have a B in pile 2, a D in pile 3, A, C, and E in pile 4, and it looks like I've got G in pile 5 and F in pile 6, which I wasn't expecting.
Okay, so keep going. Anytime you have a pile with 2 or more tiles in it, you keep one of these moves.
Right. I'll just keep going until it finishes, shall I?
Yeah. But tell me when you're done, but don't tell me what you see.
Okay. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. So I predict that in the left 3 bins you have A, B, C, the middle bin is empty, and in the right 3 bins you have D, E, and R.
No, I've done something wrong then. Ah. I have a D in the fourth bin. Did I go wrong somewhere?
Well, I can shadow you if you switch to video so I can watch what you're doing.
Oh, okay.
Maybe this is part of what we should do. So I'm gonna do a little bit of a I'm gonna be a little disingenuous. Let's pretend that we didn't just do that, and we'll try and create audio
Yeah.
that will edit
Okay.
that out of reality.
I'm going to find an actual F and an actual G now because I had some different letters. Just to clear it up.
Oh wait, did you do 7 tiles or six?
I had six originally, but when you said seven, I got another one out.
Oh, that was my mistake. Yeah,
Okay.
I was jumping ahead. I was going to have you do seven after you did six.
Right, okay. That'll be what. Well, then in that case, I had exactly what you said, apart from I had a D in the fourth one. There are no Fs in Bananagrams, it seems. Well, okay, since this is going to end up being audio, and I think we cleared up that I should have got it right. Do you want to go through it again, or?
Well, so I guess what we could do is just pick up from where I say, I think you've got ABC.
Right, so ABC, and then I had a what,
But remind,
D.
I want to be consistent about our reality here. So our consensual reality is that the tiles you put in there were A, B, C, D, E, and F.
Yeah.
The R was the replacement for the G, correct?
Yeah.
The G that I shouldn't have asked you to get yet.
Yeah.
So you do have A, B, C, D, E, and F.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up from where I say, so I think you have A, B, and C in the three left bins,
Yeah.
the three piles left. Then the middle pile is empty, and you have D, E, and F to the right of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so those have been sorted.
And that's
And
an even
it's a
number of
theorem
tiles.
that if you have an even number of tiles, you always have the middle pile empty, and all the other piles have one tile each, and they're all in alphabetical order, as long as the number of tiles is even.
Okay.
You want to try it again with an odd number of tiles?
Okay.
Could be 5 tiles, 7 tiles.
Oh, five will be quicker, so we'll do that. Okay, so I'll just do a load of moves until it finishes.
Yeah, so five, put all 5 tiles into the middle pile, and then start doing these moves. But stop before the very last move.
Right,
One
okay.
move shy of the ending.
Okay, I'm at the very second last move.
Okay, so one of the pile has 3 tiles in it. I'm
Yep.
sorry, 2 tiles in it.
Sorry,
Which one's
three.
that? Three. Three. And what are the 3 tiles?
They're C, D, and E.
C, D, and E. So, if you were to send the C to the left and the E to the right, would they all be sorted?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you were to do this last move randomly, the chance that you would win, by win I mean end up with all the tiles sorted, would be 1 out of 3.
Yeah, okay. Because
Okay.
I have to pick one tile to stay the same, and it only works if I leave D.
Perfect.
Okay.
So at the last move, either you're totally sunk, or if you happen to have 3 tiles that are consecutive in the alphabet and belong together, then if you send the smallest one to the left and the largest one to the right, then you'll win. Otherwise, if you would pick the C and the D, then you would lose. And if you pick the D and the E, you would lose.
Right.
So if you pick randomly, it would be a 1 out of 3 chance of winning. So
Okay.
what we know is that if you do sort of random moves for this kind of sorting, then you'll end up with each of the piles having exactly one tile in it, and we know that the chance of your winning is at most 1/3. Because on the very last move, you have a 2/3 chance of not winning. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the surprising thing that we don't know how to prove yet. Once the even number of chips gets reasonably large, the chance of your winning just by playing randomly seems to approach 1/3.
Interesting.
So putting that differently, if you're playing this sorting game with an even number of chips, you can't lose no matter what you do, even if you make random moves along the way. If you always send smaller pile to the left and a larger pile to the right, no matter what you do, you don't have to have a plan, you just have to follow the rule, it always sorts. But if you've got an odd number of tiles, with probability approaching one, you just wait until the very last move, and then you make the last move intelligently. We don't know how to prove that.
So that's what you're trying to work out at the moment, if that's the case.
Yeah, that it's part of a circle of things that I'm playing with. Whichever one seems easiest at the moment is the one I work on until I see why that's hard and I switch to another one. But there's a bunch of parameter display that I'm working on. This is kind of at the center.
Right, so where did this idea come from?
Well, the origins go back into the 1980s with a paper called Discs, Balls, and Walls, a combinatorial game by Anderson and five other people. I can get the list of full list of authors for you at some point. But they wrote about this game in the case where instead of having tiles with labels on them, you just have unlabeled identical balls. So you start out with some number of balls in a pile in the middle, and the rule is you just take any pile that has two or more balls in it, and you send one ball to the left and one ball to the right. You just keep doing that until you can't do it anymore. And the question is, what happens? And so I think already, even in that case, this is a really nice result of theirs, which is that if the number of balls is even, then no matter what you do, you find the middle pile is empty, and then you have a string of piles of one ball each to the left and an equal number to the right, no matter what you do. And if the number of balls starts out being odd, it's the same but with a ball in the middle instead of an empty pile in the middle. And along the way, things can look very different depending on the choices you make, but somehow at the very end, you're forced to this unique configuration of balls, despite the illusory freedom you have along the way.
So how do you go about proving that? Is there some kind of parity thing happening?
I don't actually remember the proof at the moment.
Okay.
There is a nice argument I do remember, which may be a component of the proof, which is suppose you were playing a game like this, of this kind, and you look at a configuration that was achieved somewhere along the way, and you were wondering how many moves have happened. And this is related to the question, how do we know the game can't get into an infinite loop? I mean, I said that you always end up with this final configuration, but you might think, well, can't this game eventually cycle back on itself? And the answer is no. Do you want to think about why or take a guess as to why or how do you prove that?
So you would have to find a way back to a state you've already been in by applying the rule, but stuff always flies out to the left and stuff always flies out to the right. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, stuff is flying out to the left and it's flying out to the right. So it's getting sort of more spread out. So we would like some sort of quantity that measures that spread that's only increasing in time or only decreasing in time, so that you can never come back to where you started.
Okay, so is how do you do that? How do you measure it?
Well, it's the sort of population variance of these chips. You sort of, if you think about where the center of mass of, I keep on saying chips, but I'll say tiles or balls, or I'll pass back and forth and use different words. The center of mass stays the same because whenever you do one of these actions, you send one ball one space to the left and another ball one space to the right. So if you think about the mean of the locations of these balls, that's not changing. It's always dead center. But if you think about what happens to the variance, it always increases by two. And this requires a slight algebraic check. But what we're doing is we're taking two balls, which are both at location k, and then we're replacing them by one at location k minus one and one at location k plus one. So if you use one of the formulas for the variance in terms of the sum of the squares of the variables in your population, in one case you have k and k, and in the other case you have k minus 1 and k plus 1. And if you compare k squared plus k squared with k minus 1 squared, plus k plus 1 squared, you can see that it's gone up by exactly 2.
Okay.
So I don't know if you can flash on a little bit of algebra onto this podcast at some point. That's not a video. But anyway, that's something that's fairly easy to check. And it's intuitive. You can think about what variance is supposed to measure. It measures the spread. So in fact, you can't come back to where you started. But also, since the variance increases by exactly 2, every time you do one of these moves, you can compare the variance at any stage along the way to the variance of the initial configuration where all the balls are on the middle pile, and you can see exactly how many moves have passed.
Okay. Good. So the variance will be 2 times the number of moves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's one other thing I can remember about the proof, which actually tells you that all the different ways you can play will end up with the same configuration. It just doesn't tell you what that configuration is. So it's a sort of an existence argument. It doesn't quite give you computational control of the outcome. But the idea is, intuitively, when you perform one of these moves, which are called firing moves, where you take 2 balls at one side and you fire them outward, that might be a move you can do in several different locations, but doing it in one place isn't going to make it impossible to do it in another place. In fact, it might facilitate its neighbors being able to do that kind of move at the next step.
Okay. I think I follow that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a kind of a lemma called, I think, the Church-Rosser lemma or the confluence lemma. It's a lemma in computer science, which says that in cases like this, if doing a certain operation in one case doesn't foreclose options elsewhere, and if the game is to just use up all your options until there are no options left, then because there's no competition going on between the different sorts of options you might want to do, and any option that becomes available must eventually be exercised and can't foreclose other options, this lemma says that eventually you must end up at the same final state with every possible option being exercised a certain fixed number of times. It doesn't depend on anything you do along the way. I know that's kind of vague, but it's sort of nice.
That sounds like a good theorem.
Yeah, it's a good theorem. It applies in lots of combinatorial contexts where you see this phenomenon of confluence, where apparent choices don't in fact give you any choice about the final state. And there's a Wikipedia page on Church-Rosser lemma, I believe, so people can turn to that.
Okay.
So anyway, I was aware of this work on disc balls evolved, and then this Indian mathematician physicist named Deepak Dhar got interested in these kinds of models, but he reinvented them from a totally different point of view. He was interested in this phenomenon in certain physical systems called self-organized criticality, which you can see if you go into a certain kind of gambling parlor, and it's the kind of thing where you put a token or into a machine.
In Britain, that's called shove halfpenny, where you drop a coin down, and then eventually it pushes a load of coins over the edge of a tray.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So when you look at it, it certainly looks like a lot of action is about to happen.
Yeah.
This is sort of driven through a sequence of small avalanches to a state that's sort of critically poised on the verge of the very next.
There's actually a game show on British TV that's entirely that game. Nobody could believe it when it came on because it's the stupidest game you could put on TV. But that is literally it. They have to put they answer questions to be able to put a coin in the machine. So that's self-organized criticality.
Well, the sort of patterns when there's I guess self-organized criticality doesn't necessarily imply that there are interesting patterns in the state of the system as it's being driven to criticality by these dynamical rules that are set up. But some people who see complexity in nature think that one driving force is precisely this kind of tendency of systems to be driven to states where something is about to happen, because smaller things keep happening along the way. And I'm not saying this very well, but if you look up self-organized criticality, you'll see some nice descriptions of this. And so people develop things called the sand pile model or the chip firing model. And they're very interested in these sort of avalanches that happen.
Okay.
So that's a part of the story that happened in the 1980s and 90s. And then some people like Lionel Levine decided that they wanted to explore these sorts of systems as a model of computation, where you have agents that are not synchronized with each other. So if you think about these piles of being agents, where each agent has the ability to recognize when it's got two or more tiles in it and to send them to neighboring processors, you can think of this as a sort of model of distributed processing. And you'd like to know whether this whole network is able to achieve some sort of concerted, consistent final state, regardless of the fact that the individual processors can't see beyond themselves and their neighbors. That somehow what happened in the end, maybe through some magic involving the precise setup, will achieve, you know, a final state that's predictable ahead of time.
Okay.
So this work of Anderson et al. Sort of fits into that framework, although it's just the one-dimensional case, and where things get really interesting is when these sand piles are set up on two-dimensional grids. In fact, I may give you a link to some beautiful pictures of what happens when you do something similar in two dimensions, where you start piling grains of sand at the origin, where the rule is that as soon as a site in this grid has four more grains on it, it fires a chip to each of its four neighbors, a grain, I should say, each of its four neighbors. And if you were to pile up a million grains in at the origin and then let the system relax, you get a really, really beautiful pattern formed by the grains of sand. If you color the sites according to whether they're 0, 1, 2, or 3 grains, you get a beautiful sort of fractal pattern that people are still actively working on trying to understand. It's quite deep and beautiful.
Okay. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
It reminds me, there was a puzzle game back. I must have played it in the 90s. It was like that, where it was molecules and you can... you have a grid and each cell has 0, 1, 2, or 3 in it. And you can click on it to make it explode and spread one to
the
surrounding cells.
That's the game.
Okay. But so the idea with that puzzle was it's hard because finding the winning state is one particular path of choices down it. But what you're looking at is if you're picking at random, will you always end up with something the same? If you let it spread out.
I guess that's a different game then, because the game I'm thinking of always gets to the same final state no matter what you do.
Yeah, well, it's not a homogeneous space. It's like there are walls between some of the cells, and it's very small. And you're never adding numbers in. You're never splitting them up, so it ends quickly. Maybe I'll find that game and.
That's a natural way to segue. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay.
No, talking about games where you can win or lose, and puzzles is a sort of a natural segue into the next part, because I still haven't said how I came up with this. And part of it was, as part of the Global Math Project, I'm trying to join this effort to come up with cool activities related to James Tantum's exploding dots approach to teaching mathematics. But I should say a bit about that. One of the inspirations for Tantum's work was a talk that I gave, which was based on work that a guy named Arthur Engel had done back in the 1970s when he was trying to teach probability theory to fourth graders. And he came up with this thing that's very much like exploding dots that he called the probabilistic abacus, and I'm calling it Engel machines. And I'm actually making some videos about that. But that's sort of the basis of a lot of this stuff. And it has this beautiful feature that it's very predictable, but I thought, well, if you want to make a puzzle out of something, you don't want this feature that things are so predictable. You want the ability to make some choices and to have the choices maybe work out or maybe not. So that's part of where I was coming from, where I was thinking in terms of putting labels on these balls and actually having it be a sort of sorting procedure, is that you have to be at least a little bit intelligent. If you didn't have the constraint that says you have to send the earlier letter to the left and the later letter to the right, there's no reason you would end up with these things being sorted. What's surprising is that if you just keep that small rule in mind, you can do surprisingly well at sorting. But It's a different type of a sort of a problem you might have when you're trying to move tiles around in such a way that you reach a desired end state. And what was disappointing to me in some ways as a puzzle designer is that if you're trying to sort a bunch of tiles that way, starting from that initial state, there's really only one rule to keep in mind, which is don't do anything stupid. And then the puzzle solves itself. But I was able to come up with some other sorts of puzzles of this kind that start with different initial states. And in fact, if you have a window you could open up now, you can go to a piece of software that I designed and that the programmer created for me called ChipChip, which you may have seen already. I don't know if I
Yeah,
shared that with you.
I'm on the math friend list. I think there's you put it on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Go to mathenchant.org slash ch. So that's not spelled CHIP. Actually, I forget how I spell
you did spell it chip
that.
chip CHIP.
CHIP slash. Or is it CHIP.html?
Just a slash on the end.
HTTP colon slash slash mathenchant.org slash chipchip.html. No?
It's a slash on the end, not the
Oh, I think
HTTP.
it's okay. Yeah, so mathenchant.org slash chipchip slash. Okay, so it takes you to this page, and here we're trying to sort tiles into alphabetical order. I'm sorry, not in, we're trying to sort tiles from a word, which typically does not mean sorting them in alphabetical order. So you can have number mode or word mode. So this is still very much a work in progress, but the hope is to find fun puzzles where you have an initial state that maybe has some of the letters in a perverse order. So letters that belong near the end of a word or at the beginning towards the left, and letters that should be near the beginning of a word or towards the right, but somehow using the freedom you have to move these tiles around, you can achieve that end state. So in this particular app, you actually have two kinds of moves, one of which takes two tiles that are in the same rack and moves them apart, and the other is a move that takes two tiles that are not in the same rack, but are two racks apart and moves them together into the intervening rack in the middle. So with those two kinds of moves, instead of having it be a problem about whether you can achieve it or not, it becomes a problem about can you achieve it in the smallest possible number of moves.
Okay, so does this an explode move make it so that you can? Oh, of course it does, because you there's always a way to get to a sorted state, and this is sort of an undo, the unexplode. Is that right?
That's it.
Okay. So you have to do that as few times as possible.
That's it.
Okay. So
Well, I don't
that's a
know if
really good
any of
puzzle.
I don't know if any of your listeners might be inclined to help develop this, but and I think it would be fun to try and find the hardest possible puzzles of this type that are still doable. I did a little bit of exploration of this on my laptop, mostly by brute force. So my experience is that even the hardest puzzles I've been able to find don't take me more than 5 minutes to solve if I allow myself to sort of backtrack and rethink where I'm coming from. But it's not a single strategy that seems to work. It's sort of an intuition I've developed for when I'm getting in trouble because certain tiles are getting too near the end. Because once a tile gets to the end, there's no chance of bringing it back in. But it's possible that this is a game that will yield to a simple strategy, but so far I have not found a simple strategy that always works.
Okay. That is a very interesting game, and it seems like it's a very simple puzzle to explain. It feels like it'll become a classic.
Yeah, I hope it could gain some popularity, but at this point my time is limited for developing it. I'm hoping to have a small community of like-minded people who think this is a thing worth developing. And and spreading it around through the Global Math Project.
Later on, I may be able to help you with that because I do a lot of coding with funny stuff. But can we get back to the maths for the moment? So you've come up with this puzzle, and your puzzle designer hat, you're trying to think of ways of making it interesting and difficult, but then a maths question must have occurred to you.
Yeah, I mean, they sort of went hand in hand. I mean, I was developing both at the same time, and so it was occurring to me as I was designing ChipChip that it'd be rather fun if the solution to the puzzle about why, with an odd number of chips, it always ends up being sorted no matter what you do, if in fact the solution to that came from gamers and the insights that gamers might bring to playing the game, rather than the insights mathematicians might find by just thinking about things abstractly. So that's not how things worked out, because this game is still only known to a few dozen people, and working with Thomas McConville and Sam Hopkins, the problem about an odd number of chips has now been solved. But they figured this out, I think, not by playing with puzzles, but just by thinking hard about the combinatorics.
Okay. So how familiar are how what's the word? How comfortable are you with their proof of it in the odd number case?
I've gone through it. They walked me through it, and I like it. It's nice. It's complicated enough that I don't have to feel embarrassed that I didn't find it. But it's also complicated enough that I don't feel I really deeply understand it yet. So I'm still trying to master the proof.
Right. Can you give me a rough idea, like a rough sketch of the argument?
I can't really give you a rough sketch of the argument. I mean, there's an induction in it. I can tell you that that's part of the sketch of it. There are some preparatory lemmas, and there's an idea, which is that you expand the allowed roll set, so you're also allowed to move a single tile to the right without moving any tiles to the left.
Okay.
And so somehow by the extra elbow room you get by relaxing the rules, you're able to get a broader context in which you can state the kind of lemmas that you really need to solve the problem.
Okay, and so that breaks your invariant about the mean, and it breaks the rule about the variance. So is there some way of pulling that back towards when you've done that move, you can instead have done some different moves that were legal earlier on?
Interesting. I don't know. I mean, I should clarify that adding this extra move where you're allowed to move a tile to the right doesn't actually apply to the part of the proof where you're looking at labeled tiles. There's a part of the proof where you just look at the original unmarked balls scenario,
right,
and you just prove some lemmas there which turn out to be relevant to the labeled tiles. Here's a way to think about it. Suppose the tiles are labeled with numbers of 1 through n, but we're only looking at where some of the tiles go. So if we're only looking at some of the tiles, then it's possible for one of the tiles to move to the right, and one of the tiles that we're not looking at to go to the left, so we don't actually see that one move anywhere because it's not actually in our purview.
Uh-huh.
So if you're playing this game with labeled tiles, where in lieu of labeling, you just say some of them are visible and some of them are invisible, then what you can see is normal moves where two visible balls fire, and we can see other moves where they're both invisible, so we see nothing happening at all. And then these odd sort of moves where one of them is visible and one is invisible, so we just see one thing moving to the right.
Okay.
Is that
yeah,
sort of sense?
I think I'm on board with that. I can see why you'd want to do that. Yeah.
So that's another part of the setup that they did.
So is that the problem you gave me at the beginning? That was the game with labeled tiles, and when it's an odd number of them, what was the question again? The
Yeah,
what,
if you have
oh.
an odd number of tiles, then as long as you don't do anything stupid along the way, then they always sort. Did I say odd? I'm sorry, I meant to say even.
Even.
If you have an even number, if you have, hold on, I can pause the video. Sandy, please tell the kids that they have to stay out of this room and keep the doors closed. But anyway, you can erase earlier parts anyway, so you just odd and even, and that's not going to be helpful. Yeah, the puzzle I was talking about earlier, the problem I was talking about earlier is if you have an even number of labeled tiles, then they sort as long as you don't do anything stupid along the way. Meaning, whenever you pick two tiles, you suddenly look small, the lower one earlier in the alphabet to the left and the one that's later in the alphabet to the right. And if you have an odd number of them, the rule is almost as simple. It works with probability approaching one as the number of tiles gets large. And the rule is that along the way, don't do anything stupid. And at the last move, do something slightly intelligent. You will see a pile with three chips in it. Choose the two tiles that you're going to move to be the first and last in the alphabet of those three tiles. And then send the first one in the alphabet to the left and the last one in the alphabet to the right. Won't always work, but it works with probability approaching one as the number of tiles goes. And that's the problem we haven't solved yet, is that probabilistic assertion. But we now have a proof of the case when there are an even number of tiles that as long as you don't do anything stupid along the way, it always sorts the tiles. And the time it takes grows like a cube of the number of tiles, which means that it's a bad algorithm because you can do a lot better.
Yeah, that's a bad sorting algorithm. So normally you want to talk in like logs, and if we're talking cubes, that's quite slow.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm interested in is how are you trying to attack this problem? What's your current line of thought about how you'll prove it or disprove it?
For the probability one,
Yeah.
I have no clue how to answer that one at this
Okay.
point. I mean, I like to collaborate with people, so I try and distribute these problems to people who are hardworking and smart and hope that they'll have the next idea, and maybe that will give me the idea after that. But I'm currently at an impasse on that one.
You had any false starts?
Any false starts?
Any ideas that you thought we're going to get you there, but turned out not.
No, I can't even claim to have made any false starts. I mean, there is an oversight of mine, which was that for a while I didn't understand that at the very last move, no matter how smart you've been along the way, you have a 2 out of 3 chance of failing. He went and pointed that out, and it's obvious once you think about it, but it's not obvious if you should think about it. And once you see that, you see that this thing is going to fail with probability 2/3 or greater. Unless you do something slightly intelligent to the last move. But what is baffling is that that's really all you need to have a 1/3 chance of succeeding is just to do the right thing at the very last step. I mean, it's not clear to me why at the second to last step you'd be dispensed with being smart. I just don't understand that at all. Well, maybe the conjecture is false, but so far it seems to be true.
If it was false, then there would be some arrangement where you don't end up in that last, in that state at the last move.
Well, actually, I'm now realizing I haven't really stated precisely what I mean by playing randomly, have I?
No, you haven't.
Yeah. So I can think of at least three ways to play this game randomly, of which I'll just mention two for your listeners. One of them is find at random a heap that has two or more tiles in it, and then choose at random a set of two tiles from that heap. And send the smaller one to the left and the larger one to the right. That's one way to play randomly. Another way is to pick at random from all the pairs of tiles that share a heap, which is slightly different from choosing a random heap. Because if you think about two, if there were two piles, a few piles of heaps interchangeably, if you have two piles, one of which, say, has only two tiles in, the other has four tiles in it, then the pile with four tiles has four choose two or six different pairs in it of tiles that are compatible, whereas the pile that has only two tiles in it has only one pair. So if you're picking a random pair, you have a 1 in 7 chance of picking the pair that's in the small pile, and a 6 in 7 chance of picking the pair from the bigger pile. If you pick a random pair, that's what it looks like. If you pick a random pile that has two or more tiles in it, then you have a 1 in 2 chance of picking that pair that's from the smaller pile. So the two distributions look very different move by move. And there's a few other distributions you could use for what you mean by playing this game randomly. But it doesn't seem to matter. It seems to be the case that for all these different ways of playing the game randomly, you have a 1 in 3 chance of winning the game. Or I should say approximately 1 in 3. And that becomes approximately 1 if you add the caveat that at the last move, you exercise a little bit of intelligence.
Okay. That is interesting. That's an interesting problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, since I can't get into much detail about how you might prove it, since you have no idea.
Well, no idea isn't quite fair. I don't have an
Okay, yeah.
overview. I don't have an overview.
Since you're stuck. Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you a little bit about the history. Sam Hopkins had an idea for proving that. Now let's number these tiles 1 through n, where n is an even number. So how would you prove that tile number 1 ends up in the right place? That wasn't obvious, but he was able to find a proof of that, and it also showed that tile number 2 ended up in the right place as well. But then when it got to tile number 3, things were looking a little more complicated. But he saw the beginnings of an induction argument that would let you show progressively that the tiles end up in the right place. And so that was the sort of trail he followed, which isn't the same as an overview of the final result, but if someone wanted to sort of reproduce the thought process he went through, those would be the steps to follow. First, show that things on the end up where they belong, and then try and move it towards the middle.
Okay, that makes sense. So once you've got the correct tiles to the start and the very end, do you then have something that works on a not initial state for the piles in the middle? Is that the induction?
I don't think it's exactly that, but I could look up the write-up and tell you. Who's your audience here, by the way?
We say on the site, people who already know that they like maths and want to know more. So we don't tend to cover school stuff too much. Tends to be undergrads and upwards. In fact, we don't really think about it in an education context. We don't really, I don't do any teaching. So yeah, people with maths degrees at the least, I would have thought.
Okay, so my guess is even if I could tell you what the induction is, it would be too technical for 90% of your listeners.
Well, that's what I want to get into with this, though. I want to get into the technical stuff, and even if I don't get all the rigor of it, I want to get an idea of the of what you're doing.
You should probably interview Sam or Thomas then,
Yeah,
because
okay.
they really understand the proof.
Right, so
Um,
should we skip that?
okay, I mean, it's theorem 11 that's proved by induction on K. Yeah, no, so the thing you prove by induction is exactly what you might have guessed from what I've said so far. It's that the kth chip ends up where it's supposed to, and the n over 2 plus kth chip ends where it's supposed to. And you prove that by induction. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Oh, I think there's a mistake here. No, I shouldn't say that. Cross that out. Don't say that. There's something here I don't quite understand.
Okay, I believe you. It's too technical.
But I mean, in terms of sort of what it's like to do math, if that's some of what your listeners are interested in, then I mean, I can tell you what's happening right now this week in terms of where this is going, which is that I am working with my collaborators on this stuff, but some other people have actually taken our ideas and run with them in a whole new direction, which is one that I think it's tempting to try and follow them, but it's always the sort of temptation of do I solidify what I've already got, or do I move on to the next shiny object and leave things undone with the current project. But there are these things called root systems arising in algebraic combinatorics, associated with things called Coxeter diagrams and associated with V algebras. And so that's sort of higher powered mathematics than this sort of stuff. And right now, a bunch of people at MIT have realized that what we're doing is sort of the type A case of something that can be done in type B, C, and D, and in exceptional types as well. So this is the sort of thing you run into a lot when you do a certain kind of combinatorics, is you do something and then someone else says, oh, but you're just doing the type A case because it fits into this broader context of Cartan matrices and killing Cartan classification. And so they've shown that what we've done is just a special case of something broader that is still conjectural, but they're excitedly trying to figure out how to extend these conjectures to these other cases and prove things on them. So it appears that this work may have more significance than I actually understand right now, because I'm not really playing with them at the moment on all the stuff that they're doing. Their emails every day that sort of reconfigure what came the day before in a new context and prove new things. So I'm still playing with the type A case and trying to understand some of the basic things about it.
Well, that's good. That's the classic thing about the unexpected impact of maths, isn't it? That you can be playing with you're working with very basic building blocks to start with. You're doing some really simple combinatorics things, but that can generalize or it can apply to something that turns out to be a lot more complicated. And that seems to have happened very quickly for you. Normally, you have to die and be dead for 100 years before.
So we'll have to see. I mean, I don't think this is going to be a huge thing, but I think more papers coming out of it than just the one that Sam and Thomas and I are writing. And since many of your listeners are in England, I will say that we've submitted this to a conference that's going to be held next summer in London. This is the Formal Power Series and Algebraic Combinatorics Conference. There's a decent chance that it'll either be a talk or at least a poster session on this stuff there in the summer.
Could you briefly describe to me what algebraic combinatorics is about? There's a something I'm not familiar with.
See, this is the kind of question I knew you were going to ask when you want something about what are some big theorems and why do they matter? Or what's the whole area of mathematics that you work in and how would you give an overview of it? I mean, the most simplistic answer is it's the kind of combinatorics that was developed to meet the needs of algebra. Group theory and representation theory in particular.
Okay, that's fair.
But I mean, there's also other algebraic structures like lattices and partially ordered sets. And so algebraic combinatorics is specifically concerned with those objects. And it asks some of the bread and butter questions of combinatorics, like how many, questions that begin with the words how many, dot, dot, dot. There are a lot of those in algebraic combinatorics, but but often not a great comic book. You don't just want to count things. You want to put them into some sort of partially ordered set, and you want to think about them maybe they're having some sort of group structure on them, and be whether there's algebraic operations on them. So it has connections to graph theory, it has connections to physics, but I'd say it's mostly algebra and combinatorics butting up against each other and generating interesting questions and interfaces that's given rise to algebra and combinatorics in the sense that I use the term.
Okay. So I might have bumped into this earlier today. Is sequence 1 in the OAIS something that's, it's the number of finite groups of order n. Is that, that's a how many question about something algebraic?
Well, it is, but it's not the kind of question that tends to be at the center of algebraic combinatorics, the one thing, because you can't really find a nice formula for it.
Right.
I think if you had an OEIS sequence that was the center of algebraic combinatorics, it would be the sequence of Catalan numbers.
Okay.
There's very little doubt in my mind. That's kind of the center from which a lot of other things grow outward.
Yep. Okay, cool.
Formulas, but also we like answer sequences that are answers to more than one question. And the Catalan sequence, has that property in spades, that there are, dozens and dozens of different questions which seem unrelated on the surface. But when you probe underneath, you find that the Catalan numbers were at the core of all of them.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a key feature of algebraic combinatorics, is it tends to focus on answers that are answers to more than one question. And the sequence that you were referring to, the number of finite groups of order n, was that the sequence you mentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of, I don't know of another question that that's the answer to.
No, okay, fair enough.
yeah,
and the Catalan number, the entry on the OAIS for that sequence is probably one of the longest in there.
Yeah, and I'll put a little plug here for Richard Stanley's recent book on Catalan sequence.
All right. And this is why combinatorics feels like magic to me whenever I encounter it, that you prove something by some argument that involves mental gymnastics, and then it's exactly the same as some other problem you've got, and everything just happens for you. So is that something you really enjoy about, is that fair, first of all, and is that something you enjoy about combinatorics?
Yes, it's something fair, and it's something that I enjoy. I mean, I like the element of surprise, and I find combinatorics gives to me quite a lot. And that's partly also because you can do experiments in combinatorics in ways that are hard to do in other fields, I think. Like, I spend a lot of time, when I'm doing this kind of combinatorics, moving objects around on a table. And if you're working with, Banach algebra or something like that, you can't just pick up a Banach algebra and play it. Your image froze, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Did we lose each other on this call?
I think because you moved your hands a lot, it lost. It had a lot of transmitting data to do. So
but anyway, I was just saying that. I mean, I may be showing my ignorance of Banach algebra. Maybe people who play with them find them very concrete. But for me, combinatorics has an inarguable concreteness to it that makes it easy to experiment and to be surprised, because you just get information so quickly about the objects of study by just playing with them.
Combinatorics is, it feels almost like down there with number theory as something that you can absolutely see in the real world and maybe have an intuition for and play with without much effort, but there are still problems that are easy to state but extremely hard to solve.
Yeah.
Okay. I think maybe we got to the end there. I said I'd take at most an hour of your time, and I've done that now. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover?
I did make a list of things I wanted to be sure to mention.
Okay.
But I think I mentioned all. I mentioned Chipchip. I mentioned Exploding Dots and Google Math Project. Engel Machines. I hope to make some videos about them. I think I covered everything. And I'll be glad to send you any links or if background information if you want to include any of that in whatever web pages that eventually host this podcast.
Yeah, lovely. Cool. Yeah, I'll maybe I'll send you an email asking for a reference or two. Yeah, cool, lovely. That was very interesting. Thank you for taking the time to tell me about that.
Sure. Well, thank you, Jake, for having the idea of doing this sequence of podcasts. I look forward to seeing what other people respond.
I talked to a guy in Australia this morning about topos theory, so the extreme other end of maths, really, if you could. And that would, so that would be a couple of very good ones to start with, and I think, I want to do quite a few more of these. So, yeah.
Great.
So I'll do that. I'll edit together. Might take me quite a while because I have a real job. But,
what editing software do you use? Audacity or something else?
Yeah, Audacity. Yeah. Yeah.
If you need any more audio clips, like to make a splice between two passages, let me know. I'm happy to say anything again that I said, maybe say it better or sound more spontaneous, whatever.
Lovely. Okay. I might take you up on that. Good. Okay. Lovely. I think I'll stop there then. It's quite late for me now. So thank you again, and I'll email you once it's finished or I need help.
Great. Thank you, Christian.
Right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.